Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject. Hello, I'm Chris Rokosch, president of Connect Medical Legal Experts, and welcome back to another episode of Inside Medical Malpractice, where we take a look at all things fascinating about medical malpractice from the perspective of doctors, from lawyers, from nurses, and patients. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very excited about the guest that we have and feel very lucky to have him back in the studio once again. Today, I'm going to be speaking with neonatologist Dr. Michael Narvi from the Winnipeg Health Sciences Center. Last month, Dr. Narvi and I hosted a webinar and a medical legal case study on neonatal hypoglycemia. He was a great teacher. It was a great webinar. We joined along with plaintiff lawyer Joe Miller, and the webinar was very, very well received. But he really is, over and above everything else, an excellent and approachable speaker and teacher. And he also happens to do medical legal work. So I've invited him back here today to do a podcast to talk more about his work and more about himself. If you missed that webinar, it's currently available on the connectmlx.com website. It's a fantastic resource for lawyers, for doctors, for nurses, for midwives. And note that everyone who watches that webinar and listens to these podcasts should be able to claim continuing educational hours from their professional associations. So don't miss it. And if you need support or assistance in claiming your professional ed hours, please don't hesitate to get in touch because we're always here and happy to support continuing medical education. So before we start talking to Dr. Narvi, let's talk a little bit about him so you can get a sense of just what wonderfulness you're listening to today. Dr. Michael Narvi is the section head of neonatology at the Winnipeg Health Sciences Center. He's the committee chair of the Canadian Pediatric Society Fetus and Newborn Committee. He's also the medical director of the Child Health Transport Team, associate professor at the Department of Pediatrics and Child Health, an investigator of the Children's Hospital Research Institute of Manitoba. That's a lot of pretty big, important hats to wear. He also happens to be one of the principal authors of the Canadian Pediatric Society position statement, The Screening and Management of Newborns at Risk for Low Blood Glucose. He's a busy man, like I said, a fabulous teacher. We're lucky to have him here with us today. Welcome, Dr. Narvi.
Thank you for having me, Chris. That's a very humbling, but yet wonderful introduction. Thank you for the kind words.
It's all yours. It sounds like it's all stuff that you've done. So congratulations to you for that. How are you doing today?
I'm great. I think, just as we're getting ready to have a great talk today, here in Manitoba, you know, we received the news yesterday that there are plans now to allow some interprovincial travel without quarantining or isolating upon return, which is a welcome piece of news for, I think, everyone here. So I think everyone here today has a little bit more of a jump in their step.
Oh, good. And yeah, to keep this in context, for in case you're listening to this 2 years from today, we're recording this in early June 2021. And, you know, Canada and parts of the world are certainly still in the midst of some version of COVID-19 lockdown. Yeah. So, and it's the same in Alberta. Just tomorrow, a few other things open up. And even though the world still feels pretty quiet and not quite normal, I feel like you said, just a little bit of jump in the step, a little bit more hope for what's to come.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's really good. So let's just talk. I have some questions I'd like to ask, and I think the audience will be really interested in hearing about you. Let's first talk about your decision to become a doctor, and tell us then what led you to specialize in pediatrics and then to focus specifically on neonatal medicine.
Yeah, I love telling this story. So thanks for all.
Oh, good.
The ball rolling that way, because the truth is, I never wanted to be a pediatrician, which is an interesting starting point to this discussion. I actually wanted to be an obstetrics, an OBGYN. Is what I wanted to do. I wanted to do that for almost 4 years of medical school. All my rotations, my electives were all in obstetrics and gynecology. And I applied to do nothing other than after medical school to go into residency. They were all obstetrics positions. And then I had an experience where I went off to Toronto in the summer of 1997. And I went to do maternal fetal medicine, which is high risk obstetrics, perinatology, as you would well know. And while I was out there, I was following some really, really interesting clinical conditions. But I started to wonder whether or not, for the first time in my medical career, whether I was more interested in the fetus or I was more interested in the mother. Because I had always thought I would do high-risk obstetrics. So that part hadn't changed. But then I had an experience that really changed me. I had an experience of a mother with no prenatal care who came in and delivered a baby who had various abnormal features. And, you know, I had the opportunity to work with the neonatal people and follow the baby, even though I was there on obstetrics. And ultimately diagnosed the baby with a rare condition. Not that I did, but that the team did. And I just thought that was so fascinating. And then I came back to Winnipeg where I did my medical school. My next rotation, just by coincidence, was pediatrics. And, you know, the love affair continued. I started to realize midway through that rotation that my interest was really in children, not as much women. So in the end, I applied to pediatrics. I was fortunate enough to get into the University of Manitoba. I don't regret it. You know, I think that I've carved out a nice career in that. And, you know, obstetrics could have been a wonderful thing too. And I don't want to say that I have anything against obstetrics and gynecology, but I was given one piece of advice. And I would say to any listeners out there who are, thinking about their careers, I remember somebody said to me, who was a reference of mine, actually, a very honest opinion. She knew that I was applying to pediatrics and also obstetrics, because I did it. In the end, I still applied to 10 obstetrics positions. She cornered me and she said one day, is there anything else you would ever think about doing other than obstetrics? Because she said, it's a really hard life. And she said, if there's another career out there that you're thinking of, she says, even though I think you'd be great, you know, and you think you'd be happy, you know, you should consider it. And so I sort of saw that as fate. I applied, I ranked pediatrics first, I got in. And then, you know, neonatology just flowed from there. My second rotation in into residency was neonatology. I had a fantastic time, you know, enjoyed it immensely. And, you know, I think then I had some great mentors who continued to encourage me to pursue neonatology, and that's how it happened.
I think that is such a great story, because in all of my years of obstetric nursing, I've never had this thought until this moment about breaking apart. Do you like looking after the mother or do you like looking after the baby?
Yeah.
And my passion was always around the birth process and getting the baby safely delivered, you know, within whatever power I had in the situation. But then I'd look at that baby and give it a little blessing and say, listen, you little shit, here's your mom. Be good. Have a good life and get on with things. So I would say, without ever realizing, I had a very exactly opposite experience as you, is that I love the women and I love the birth process and I love getting a baby safely into the world. But then as far as I was concerned, that was somebody else's baby. So thank God there's people like you and like me in the world. And everything gets looked after. So thanks for sharing that. That's a really great story. And I think it's amazing, too, that that mentor person, because obstetrics is no doubt a tough life, and OBGYN is. And I don't know how your life is right now, but certainly it's an on-call all the time kind of a job.
Would have been very different.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It would have been very different. And you know what? I see, you know, when you talk to, it's interesting, you know, a little off topic, I suppose, but when you talk to OBGYNs, the ones who really love it, you know, they really love it, you know, and they can't see themselves doing anything else, you know? And I think, you know, given that, you know, when you're in your 20s and you're in your 30s, you have a lot of energy, you know, and being up all night on call delivering 10 babies is not the end of the world. But you know what? You have to, when you enter your 40s and 50s and 60s, You better love it,
right.
you know, because that's where you draw your inspiration from.
Yeah, exactly. And you got to be okay with no sleep and long hours.
Correct.
And not holidays and on call. Well, anyway, thanks for sharing that. That's a really good story. So could you explain for those of the people in the audience who are listening, what is the role? Would you call yourself a pediatrician, neonatologist, or perinatologist? But what is, could you explain that role?
Sure.
Of that? What would you call yourself first? What is your title?
Well, so I'm a neonatologist, but you know what? I was given a tip a long time ago by a Dr. Casiro, who works out in BC. I don't know if you've ever crossed paths. He's a neonatologist. And he gave me the advice as a resident or a fellow. He said to me, Michael, never tell people you're a neonatologist. He said, tell people you are a newborn intensive care specialist. Because he said, most people, you know, what'll happen is you say, oh, I work in neonatology. And most people haven't heard of a neonatologist.
Right.
The people who have, unfortunately, have had a child or a grandchild, you know, go through that system. But he said, what'll happen is 9 times out of 10, people will say, oh, that's very interesting, not wanting to admit they don't know. So I work in newborn intensive care.
Okay.
And so what I do, and, you know, it's a great question, because very commonly when I tell people what I do, I get questions like, oh, it must be very difficult to operate on babies, or it must be very difficult to deliver the babies. And the way I describe it is I say that we work with the obstetricians. We receive the babies. We do not deliver them. If we're delivering them, that's a rare occurrence, but it can happen if the OBGYN is not in attendance.
Sure.
But we take care of the babies after delivery. We do not perform surgery, but we, in essence, provide medical support for the infants and consult other services when necessary in an intensive care environment for a newborn. Our population ranges from what we would consider bread and butter neonatology, the preterm infant, anywhere from about 22 weeks now up to 36 weeks. And then we also see term infants, you know, with various conditions, one of the most common being hypoglycemia or low blood glucose, which you and I have just discussed and are familiar with, obviously.
Yes.
So we have a myriad of problems that we deal with. And, you know, sometimes I will describe to people that we're like the quarterback of a football team. It's our job to oversee all the care and coordinate, you know, if patients need subspecialist care, whether it be gastroenterology, endocrinology, surgery, neurology, but we oversee the care for sick newborns.
Right. So what is a, if there is such a thing, what is a normal day like for you?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because one of the things I love about neonatology is, I'll begin with a comment, another piece of advice I was given when I was young, which was when choosing a specialty, I was told you need to decide whether you like clinics or you don't. That's the defining difference. Said, if you like clinics, go into any of the, you know, general pediatrics, subspecialties. If you don't like clinics, then NICU, PICU, or emergency is for you.
Right. And so a clinic is like a doctor's office, so to speak, right? It's what everybody would know as a doctor's office. Okay.
I like, right? So what I like is being able to see the patients, take a break, go for coffee, do some teaching with the residents and the fellows, come back, do some research or further literature reviews to see if the care I'm providing is the right care for the infant. And you don't have that luxury when you're in a general practice. It's hard to take a moment and say, am I doing the right thing? You know, I should really check the evidence for this, right? But you can do that in neonatology. So that's a typical clinical day, is doing rounds in the morning, doing some teaching, getting procedures done, whether it's, you know, chest tubes or umbilical lines or intubations, extubations that need to be done. But then there's another side to me, which is the other side that I really like, which is the administrative side. And many people would say, I can't believe you just said you like administration. But, you know, as part of my job, one of my big roles is being a section head or division head, depending on where you are in the country, you call them different things, and being responsible for all the physicians who work here. And ensuring that we follow guidelines and we develop guidelines and we, you know, adhere to them. Also serving on committees, doing research. You know, we have research projects going on all the time here. And then outside of that, I have, as you identified, the role as the chair of the Fetus and Newborn Committee for the Canadian Pediatric Society.
Yes.
And so that's an additional layer, you know, of work that I have on my plate. So, you know, and then aside from that, I managed to work something that I think is a very important and evolving aspect of all medicine these days, which is the blurring of the lines between social media and academic medicine. And that's a whole other podcast, you know, about how we disseminate knowledge and the model that existed in the past of, you know, getting your paper journal and sitting in your big chair and leafing through the journal. I mean, that's archaic. We don't do that anymore. You know, now you can gain just as much, you know, if you're on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn, as I know, you know, there is a presence of Connect experts there. You know, so much sharing goes on and information on a daily basis. And so I'm active on there in part because, you know, I gain a lot of knowledge and bring it back to the bedside through that. So that's a typical day.
That's a sounds like a busy day. And I'm really glad that you're excited by all the different parts of it. Because, you know, to some people, the stuff you describe, you'd be like, I have to go to that meeting or that committee. But it sounds like you're pretty invested in the work that you're doing. And I can just see that from your from yourself and your personality, your general manner. But I love that you just brought up that blurring of how people learn now, you know, the blurring of social media and their traditional medical learning. And I think that could be a really fascinating podcast, because that's happening across every single profession right now, isn't it? But medicine for sure is one of them that has the most serious consequences if you go down a rabbit hole and get bad information or rely on something that isn't accurate or true. So yeah, and we're certainly seeing that now with COVID, aren't we? And vaccines and people's reactions and decisions around it. But you're right, that's a whole nother podcast that we'll talk about another day. Talk to us a little bit about the highs and lows of your job. What is something that you love most about neonatology? And what are the hardest parts?
I think what I love most about neonatology is I think supporting the families through a very difficult time. You know, I think that, of course, I don't wish anyone has this experience. I think it can be very tragic, of course, here. But when you have a mother and father, or two mothers, two fathers, however the description may be,
right?
Taking them from a place of sadness and helping them get to a place of acceptance and a place of healing. And then going from a place where they see helplessness, hopelessness, to beginning to talk about what home will look like. You know, I think that is the best part of what we do. You know, interestingly, you might have thought I would say something like making a difficult diagnosis. You know, a really rare diagnosis and being the first one. This is what I used to think, actually. It's funny. If you ask me, this is, I guess, maturing of a clinician. If you asked me this question 20 years ago, in fact, I used to be asked this question, why neonatology? And 20 years ago, my answer is very different. My answer 20 years ago was, and I told everybody this, what I love about neonatology is that we get babies who have no previous medical chart. There is no history that we can go by and sneak a peek and see that they have a rare diagnosis diagnosed by somebody else. We get to make that diagnosis. We get the first crack at figuring out what is wrong. And that is something I said I really loved. And that's why I would do this instead of general pediatrics or instead of endocrinology or genetics, because we are the ones who get the first shot. But there's a double-edged sword there. And as you mature, as you become a parent yourself, you realize that while these things can be interesting at the end of the day, there's a child there and there's a family there, and they've got to cope with this rare condition that, or a terrible condition. And that's not necessarily anything to celebrate. It's something to appreciate that you've helped move along a diagnosis, but at the end of the day, there is a family there. So that's moved down in terms of priority as to what I love about neonatology. But no, supporting the family is in getting them from that initial stages to home. That's the joy.
That's a really great answer and a very compassionate and holistic answer. And I can only imagine that that attitude guides a lot of what goes on at the Winnipeg Health Sciences Center, you know, from the top down. And I think it's critically important. Yeah. And I think families will often tell you, too, that the kindness and the understanding and the compassion of the healthcare providers is just all there is. I mean, the condition and the treatment and learning the skills that you have to learn to take care of your child is what it is. But your attitude towards it will be so greatly affected by how you feel supported and whether you feel competent and whether you feel cared for. So thank you for that good work that you're doing. Thank you. Thank you. And what about the hardest parts of it? What's the toughest part of your job?
I think the toughest part has to be when you feel that you're doing everything right and the child is just not responding. And again, going back into that room, which I've had to do a few times in the last few months, and speaking to a family that's already going through, you know, a very difficult time, you know, and saying to them, and, you know, my standard line is when I'm getting close to the end of what I think we can do for a child, I'll say, you know, I have a few more tools in my toolkit, but I am running out.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we, and, you know, sometimes I've said, you know, it's really up to your child now. Like there's nothing more that I can do. It's up to them. And that's where, as a clinician, you know, just maybe your listeners don't realize this, sometimes we feel helpless.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the public's perception of a physician is that we're supposed to have all the answers, you know, and, you know, I mean, no matter what, if you think about your own life, no matter what's going on, somebody's not feeling well, you say, oh, you better go to the doctor, right? Because they'll tell you what's wrong, right? Well, so, sometimes, you know, we may be able to find out what's wrong. Sometimes we can't. And that's something we have to struggle with, is what do you do in the times of uncertainty? And that's hard. That's the really hard part. And being honest with families. The worst thing we can do, I think, is sugarcoat. I think families, they want to know the truth. I think that you're delaying the inevitable. Sometimes you'll hear, not blaming people, but sometimes the strategy is because they just don't want to give them bad news. They won't necessarily divulge exactly how bad things are. And then finally, when the writing's on the wall and you realize it's time to stop, you know, what you've done then is you've not kept the family informed, truly informed. And now you're finally telling them, when they still thought there was hope, that there's no hope. And I think part of our job is to get them there. And that's not easy. And I'm not making light of it. I'm not saying that I have all the solutions or the answers, but that's something that I think is both hard, but if done well, extremely rewarding.
Yeah. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I went through an experience not that long ago with a family member, excuse me, who died very unexpectedly. And, you know, I showed up on a Friday night and things, you know, he was dead by Sunday night. That's how kind of quickly the deterioration happened. But there was a moment in the midst of all that. He was in an ICU. There was a moment in the midst of that where the whole team of doctors, there were probably 12 of them, that got us in a circle. It was me and my sister. It was her husband and it was my husband. And they were just very direct, because, you know, we're thinking, well, he's going to, and then we're going to try this, and then we're going to do this, and we're going to do this, and then he's going to have a different chemo on Monday morning. And, you know, we're still there. And these 12 doctors looked us straight in the eye, and they said very simply, he's showing all the signs of someone who's dying. And then they listed those signs, which to me made perfect sense. And that made the decision and the going forward so much easier. I can't even tell you how much I appreciated that honest conversation. So I think you're on the right path there to talk to people that way. There was no sugarcoating. There was no, we can try one more thing. There was not, let's keep going until this happens. He's like, right. He's dying. Yeah. And let's make some, and then we made decisions around that and had a very lovely, peaceful death with the right people in the room. And, you know, it went like it went. So, you know, from my opinion, as a patient who's been through this recently, I would say that was that's a golden approach. It's tough. Yeah. And it was tough to hear. But in hindsight, it left us with a lot of peace and a path forward. And I was really grateful for that.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, not good that it happened, but I mean, that aspect of it is.
Yeah. But if there's a good death and a good way for this kind of crappy stuff to happen, that was it. It brought a lot of peace to everybody. There's no going back and second guessing. No. It's like he was dying and that was the right decision, period. So it was good. So let's talk about something else a little bit. I was reading an article yesterday, and this is kind of just a little bit about you, because I get a sense from you that you're very bright, you're very articulate, you're really personable. But I was reading this interesting article yesterday on the traits it takes to be a great pediatrician. Mm-hmm. And then I also read in the Globe and Mail today that personality tests are just a waste of time. And no one should ever use them. But I just thought I'd run these by you and see what rings true to you. First of all, it says you have to have a lot of patience. Is that something you got?
Loads.
Oh, loads.
My wife said to somebody the other, it was maybe a week or two ago, she said she has never met anyone with more patience than I.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. You have to be a great communicator. I'm going to say that's true. I'm going to answer that question for you. Okay. You're a great communicator. A lifelong learner.
Clearly. Yeah. Clearly. You know, that's something. I mean, I've always been into education and learning more. Absolutely. Yeah.
Awesome. A child health advocate.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah. A broad perspective on, among other things, the wild diversity that's found in families and the way people care for their children.
Yeah, I think that that's something that in pediatrics you have to have, and especially in Canada, we live in a very multicultural melting pot society, and
yes,
and you know what we're blessed by is a lot of support from social work, from our Indigenous health network of supporters that inform us, you know, yes, about. Different practices, different experiences that may shape how families parent. Yes. Something that I've virtually stricken from my vocabulary is the expression, how did that happen?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, quite often, you know, we use our own lens, our own experience, you know, as a judgment as to what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And then when you start to learn, you know, I'll give you a very basic example. Obesity on reserves in our Indigenous population. Well, when all you have, I mean, this will be a generalization, but I visited as my residency, I visited these reserves and did some work there. And when the cost of pop is far cheaper than milk,
yeah,
and when the only milk you have is whole milk, so you have no option to feed your infant 2%, is it any wonder, you know, that you have problems with obesity, dental caries? Yeah. It's, you know, and so, but if you don't know that, if you've not gone to these locations, if you've not personally seen what's available, it's very easy to come in the hospital and as a medical student and take care of a child and say, how did this happen? Yeah. You know, and be judging. So yeah, no, I think that that's something that pediatricians, if they don't have, I would encourage everyone to go and grab some perspective as to what you're dealing with. It doesn't mean that you have to give up, but it does mean that you need to at least address at the source what the problems are.
So where do you go and grab perspective from?
Well, I think like what's that?
Is there a store?
No, I think talking, like just talking to families talking to families in a non-judgmental way.
Yeah.
You know, and asking the questions, if we're talking, I don't do general pediatrics, but I would say, if you had that child with obesity, asking the questions, well, what is it that you feed?
Yeah.
What milk do you drink? Does your child, I hate to say it, but there's 9 months old getting Coke, because that's what's available, right?
Yeah. And, sure.
And the other reality is, if all of your friends are doing the same thing, your perspective is that is normal.
Yeah.
Right? So I think coming from a place of inquiry rather than judgment, I think that's where you get that perspective.
I agree. That's a very, very, very good point. I had a tough lesson like that in nursing a few years ago where a woman came in and she was about 36 weeks pregnant and she'd had some early prenatal care and they knew that there were some congenital malformations with the baby and some problems with the pregnancy, with her kidneys, with her blood pressure. And she'd never come into the hospital again, from 12 weeks to 36 weeks, even though these problems had been identified. And I stood there at the bedside. I started an IV. I drew some blood work. I did some things I had to do. And I was trying really hard to project caring and acceptance. And I am so glad you're here. But honestly, in my head, I'm thinking, why haven't you been here this whole time?
Yeah.
And I obviously did the worst job ever of hiding my true intention because I left the room for about a minute. And when I came back, there's blood all over the floor. She's ripped out her IV and the IV tubing and she left and she said, that nurse hates me. That nurse is judging me. And I thought, well, damn, you can't even just pretend to be compassionate and understanding. You've got to dig deep enough to really find that compassion and understanding for whatever that patient's situation is. Because I was very transparent and we lost a patient. She left. And I don't know when and if she ever came back, to be honest, because she just wasn't in the system.
Well, and it's not just yourself. I mean, one of the things you made an assumption about is communication. And, we all like to think we communicate well, but sometimes evidence, is to the contrary, so much of, it's interesting. So much of communication is about how you deliver the messaging, because I'm sure you've had that experience and maybe you even had that in that case where when you recall, and I know there's lots of studies on bias and recall, but when you recall what you said in your head, often it sounds perfect, and not to get too much into spousal relationships, but I mean, the number of times, I've said, well, I communicated that. And then I'm told.
I told you.
Yeah, no, you didn't. And I say, no, I told you, blah, 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 blah. And I'll remember. I'll say, it was yesterday. We were having breakfast. And I said, da, 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 da. And then I'll hear, well, I took that to mean this and this.
Yeah. So,
yes, I communicate. Yeah. But do I communicate effectively? And I think that's really what you're talking about. Because, Chris, I mean, as I get to know you a little bit, you also seem to be cheerful. Good listener, you ask appropriate questions, obviously intelligent, all of these things. And so I have no doubt in some way, shape or form, you believed you were doing the right thing for the patient and you believed you were communicating at the time in a clear and direct, respectful way. But how that information is heard.
Right.
And you can't control that. I mean, that's a whole other topic is relationships and how you deal with people when they're not seen eye to eye. And the one thing I've learned in my life is so far is we can only be responsible for ourselves, and what we cannot control. And you just gave a good example. What we can't control is how other people process and what they hear.
Yeah.
And the nonverbal, like how many times have you said something which you meant to be completely innocuous? Well, maybe you've never done it. I've done it. I shouldn't put you on the stand. I've done it.
Don't worry. I've done it.
I've said things that are, I believe are completely innocuous, shouldn't incite any reaction at all.
Right.
And yet I had a colleague once, actually, as I think about it, I made a comment which was purely an intellectual comment. It was a question. But I received a phone call the next morning from this colleague saying, "Do you think I lack competence?" And I said,
"Yep."
No, I said, what do you mean? And he said, "Well, you mentioned in rounds, you asked this question, so I'm inferring that you think I made a mistake." Mm. And he was really upset. And I said, "Absolutely not." I said, "I really didn't know. I didn't know. And I was raising it as a question, not questioning your competence, but saying, in general, do we really know what the right approach is here? Not right. Do you know what the right approach is here?
Right.
Does the greater we, the medical establishment, know?"
Right.
And so, yeah, so I think, that is at play quite often. And as a general pediatrician or as a neonatologist, one of our jobs, to bring it back to the original question, one of our jobs is to listen, really listen, and also watch the nonverbal.
Yes.
And one strategy that I like to use is, calling people out on what I think I'm seeing. So I think sometimes the weaker of us, we convey a message and we can see that the family or the child is not quite feeling right about this message. And you have two choices at that point. You can say to yourself, "Okay, message delivered. I got to get to the next patient. Let's move on."
Right.
Or you can call it and you can say, "I just said this. I'm not sure if you're happy with that."
Yeah. Good. Well said. Yeah. Well said.
Am I missing something?
Yeah.
Or am I onto something? Can you help me out here? And I think a lot of times when you say that, and you make yourself vulnerable and you make yourself approachable,
yes,
you'll get that response you're looking for, which sometimes is actually, "No, things are fine." You're off. But sometimes they'll say, "Yeah, you use this word.
Yes.
It made me upset. Okay, let's talk about it."
Oh, good. Well, that sounds like a great approach. And I think it makes your patients and their family feel heard and seen. You're not just there to deliver a message. You're there to make sure that they understand the message, and a huge communication issue in healthcare, in a lot of medical legal work for sure. It's probably the top issue is that communication issue.
Yeah.
So two more traits about the pediatrician. Let's just run through them really quick. One says you're a great multitasker.
Mm-hmm.
You can empathize with others. I'm going to answer that for myself because I think you just answered that beautifully in that conversation. And the last one is you're young at heart. Are you actually a 12-year-old captured in your an adult body?
I'll answer it this way.
Yeah.
9 o'clock last night, I hopped on my bicycle and I drove around the neighborhood just like I did when I was 12 years old. Like just for fun. And I rode without holding the handlebars, just like I did when I was 12 years old, balancing as I'm driving along, waving at people as, I would describe myself as still as young at heart. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think you connect really well with children and and young families in that way too. I'm for sure. So on to the next question. You and I first connected because of your authorship, your principal authorship on the Canadian Pediatric Society statement called "The Screening and Management of Newborns at Risk for Low Blood Glucose." And how do you get to be that guy who writes the guideline that guides the country? Were you invited? Were you asked? Were you voluntold? I mean, how does that happen that you end up being a principal author of such an important paper?
Well, the way that came about was, let me think about that. I was on the Fetus and Newborn Committee as a committee member at the time. Thierry Lacaz in Calgary. I don't, your viewers may know who this is. He's a neonatologist who's the section head in Calgary. He at the time was the chair of the Fetus and Newborn Committee. And as part of process, every few years we have to look at the guidelines or the statements, sorry, practice points that are out there. And we need to determine whether or not they should be removed, whether they should be revised, whether they should be just approved again. And so the statement on hypoglycemia was quite old. And so he asked for, the way we work in our committee, which I am now chair of, is, you know, you try to distribute the work, and you try to distribute the work to people who have an interest in something. And so I wasn't voluntold to do it. I volunteered to do it because my colleague and I, Seth Marks, he's a pediatric endocrinologist here in Winnipeg and co-author of the statement. We had already spent a fair bit of work converting Winnipeg to essentially what wound up being the statement back in 2016. We were quite moved by the work from the Pediatric Endocrine Society in 2015, which was published then, and felt that there was a lot of sensibility around their recommendations. And so we started to change things in Winnipeg. And so because we'd already done all the work, when the request came that we needed somebody at the CPS to work on this document, I tapped Seth on the shoulder and I said, you know, we've already done, you know, a lot of the work on this here in Winnipeg, and developed algorithms. Why don't you and I partner together, you know, and we'll write the national guidelines. So that's how it came about. We volunteered, and it was a great experience to work, you know, work collaboratively with another colleague, a friend, you know, and come out with something that I think, for the most part, has been accepted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, after a bit of a journey, as you described to
yes.
us.
And, I decided not to go through it again.
Yeah.
Yes, as a bit of a journey.
Sure. But if anyone out there listening feels like reading it or seeing this guideline, it's a Canadian Pediatric Society guideline titled The Screening and Management of Newborns at Risk for Low Blood Glucose. It's easily available online, and there is an algorithm that goes with it too that describes sort of the guidelines for care. So if you need that or you're just interested in getting it, it's easy to find. So let's switch gears a little bit, because this particular podcast happens to be about medical malpractice. So let's shift into that arena a little bit. Have you, as a neonatologist, ever been named in a lawsuit?
I have not.
You have not?
No. Thankfully, I have not.
Yes. Yeah. Thankfully, you have not. That's really good. Yeah. But I do understand that you do some medical legal expert work. We've talked a little bit about that. What motivated you to get into that aspect of doctoring?
I think someone that I think, Chris, you may know, or certainly your listeners may know, my division head or section head back when I worked in Edmonton, just north of you, was Johnny Venarda.
Yes.
Johnny had done a great deal of medical legal work himself. And as my division head, one day there was a case that he said he just didn't have the time to take on. And he said, how would you like to do some of this work? And I did. I picked it up. Very different in those days. It was about 11 years ago or so I started doing this, and it came as about 3-inch thick bound binder. Now, of course, we typically get these things on a little stick, a digital copy, which I'm much happier receiving, by the way. I received that and found it, I would say it takes a bit of work, of course, but I found it very rewarding. I found it very interesting, looking at different practices. And one of the things that's a real eye-opener was seeing that, you know, you can have, I mean, we all have exposure to the same literature. So we all have the same opportunities to review the literature and come to our conclusions about what is best practice. But it's surprising sometimes that what you think is best practice and what other centers think is best practice are different.
Yes.
And so that's how I got into it. Yeah. And from there, there was a long dry spell, I'll say, where, you know, because I certainly didn't have my name out there. But there was a long dry spell. And then I picked up a few cases along the way from people who reached out. And I don't even remember how they, actually, I do know how they found my name. It was once I became involved in 2015 is when I set up my Twitter profile and my Facebook site and so forth. And as my name started to get out there, then people found me.
And when you say you found the work really rewarding, what parts of it were rewarding for you?
I think that, you know, every medical student at some point will have a guest lecture from the Canadian Medical Protective Association. And in that lecture, they show you all the pitfalls of what not to do in medicine to keep yourself out of trouble. But unfortunately, I think for many people, it goes in one ear and out the other, because they quite honestly, they say, well, no, that would never be me. You know,
right.
They just think, yeah, you know, other people would do that. That's not me.
Right.
But then when you start doing this work and you realize that, oh my goodness, like the same things that they warned us about, lack of documentation, poor communication, not adhering to local guidelines. I mean, all of these things that they talk about are actually at the root of many of these lawsuits.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, in many ways, you know, although, you know, we do this work and we're compensated for it, there have been times where I look at something and I'll say, oh my goodness, you know, I may have done that.
Yeah.
You know, I am actually possibly guilty of doing something similar. Now, the outcome was different.
Yeah.
And it didn't result in a lawsuit, but I make a mental note and I say, you know what? I'm not doing that again.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, just from this past weekend, I was on call. And the fact that I do this work actually changed my behavior, because there was a patient, which I can't obviously go into the details of the patient, but all I will say is there was a patient with a condition that was high risk for adverse outcome. I managed the patient, gave some advice, and overnight gave some advice. And so the next day we did rounds and I was preparing to go home. And I thought, you know what? I better go back and leave a note. I better document the discussion I had overnight. I better document the advice I've given for the day staff, the fact that I've communicated with the family, and what I have told them specifically. And had I not done the legal work, I might have just gone home. I might have just said, you know what, I'm sure the day staff will document and assume. But what I've learned is, I mean, documentation is so key for everything we do, but in particular, you kind of know where the hot spots are, you know, and where you're putting yourself at risk. So I, not only do I document, but I frequently, you know, I take the opportunity as an educator as well. You know, another example on the weekend, one of our house staff went home, or they were on their way home, and they'd not clearly documented something that had happened, which I thought was rather important. And I called them back and I said, I don't know how far away you are from the hospital, but I said, you need to document this. And I said, it's not just because it's a tick box, but because if something now goes wrong, there's no record at all of the things you just did,
right,
and the decisions you made.
Right.
And so it's made me into, I think, a safer physician.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, having said that, I am well aware that before my career is over, at some point, I am likely to be named.
No, don't say it. No.
but it's because not because of anything I might do myself.
Right.
But you asked at the beginning what neonatology is, like what it is. And we are a group practice.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that well, I shouldn't say necessarily named, but my understanding is that when there is a lawsuit, you go through the whole chart and anybody's names that are in there, you know, whether you were the one who was on for the shift when something adverse happened or not, you might be, your name might appear. So,
sure.
But I will, I deem to be safe.
Well, that was one of my questions, is how has this changed your practice and how has it changed your approach to medicine and teaching? So thank you so much for answering that. And, you know, I do a lot of, or I have done a lot of expert opinion on obstetrical cases. And you're absolutely right. If there's any question about how the neonatal care is handled, you know, there's the issue of the delivery and the resuscitation in the delivery room. But if anybody raises questions about how the NICU course of treatment went, certainly you see NICU nurses and doctors getting pulled into the lawsuit, at least for the discovery, to get things sorted. But I hope it doesn't happen. But that will be another experience that you will not like, I promise you. But it changes you as well for the better. I've only ever been named once, and I feel really fortunate for that. And I was a very young nurse. And in hindsight, it wasn't, you know, now that I understand a lot about malpractice, it wouldn't have been a malpractice suit at all. It was a patient that had was put into isolation because she had some infection. And she actually sued the unit in the hospital and the nurses caring for her, saying that was very traumatic for her to be put in isolation. And it was my, and she got well and went home at the end of the day. So there wasn't really any damages there, but it was my documentation, just that I, doing exactly what you said you do. I just sat down, I talked to her, I explained her. I said, I know this is hard, but this is how it's got to be for a few days to protect all the other mothers and babies on this unit. And that little bit of documentation, saved. The hospital lawyer came to me afterwards and said, you saved the day. And I didn't even know it had happened. But the lessons like that teach you again more, you know, more and more about how to be a better practitioner.
Yeah.
So, Jen, do you have a case that you're free to talk about? And I'm not sure what stages or where the, that you're free to talk about that's particularly memorable or held a very poignant lesson for you?
You know what, I think that the case that will always be in my memory, you know, was a case that I can't give too many specifics, because while I think it may have been resolved now, or closed, it could still be open. But there was a case I was involved with a resuscitation that had gone very badly. And the resuscitation had been filmed by the father during the delivery, or right after the delivery, he filmed it. And it was what was difficult about that case was, you know, having your instincts, like, you know how to resuscitate a newborn, and watching what unfolded.
Yeah.
A lifeless baby who clearly is ashen, and people are just saying, oh, they're just taking time, you know, and not doing anything, you know, for a long time, you know, for at least a minute, you know, with no support and no checking a pulse, no nothing. You know, and you're watching this and you're thinking, do something, you know?
Yeah.
And that will always stay in my memory because it was visual. I mean, and to be frank, that's the only video I've ever seen in a case. All others have just been written on the page. So I've not been able to witness something. And so that was something. And, you know, one of the things that I've done, and I don't want to overstate my experience, I think I've now done, I haven't counted actually, but I guess between 10 and 15 opinions. And there's many times I find where it's very difficult to really say with certainty that what happened equals the adverse outcome.
Right.
You know, almost always there's other factors, you know, that one says, well, yes, this probably didn't help, but, you know, they also had this risk factor and this risk factor and this risk factor. And so it's very difficult. But the reason this case was so memorable was because even though the baby clearly was born after having had significant in utero, I will just say asphyxia, because I think ultimately that's what the MRI showed, if I recall. That complete lack of following NRP,
right,
to me, led me to voice an opinion that was far more on the side of, I believe inadequate resuscitation here has played a role.
Sure.
So that was the most memorable, because it was to me more definitive, whereas much of the work that I've done is, you know, you're talking about, you know, may have contributed.
Right.
But you can't be more certain than that.
Sure. Well, I don't think there's a malpractice lawyer on the planet that will say that is the biggest challenge. Always is the causation issue is always the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
And certainly as a well-versed practitioner, you'll see it from many, many angles. There isn't always a straight line from A to B, is there?
Of course not. Yeah.
So do you have any comments, good or bad or otherwise, on how or if you think the malpractice system as we have it set up in our country right now plays a role in healthcare, improving it, changing it, challenging it? Any thoughts on that?
You know, I think the only thing that I can say is sort of hearkening back to my previous answer is, I think as clinicians, we're all aware that every time we treat a patient, there's risk, medical legal risk, I mean. You know, I think that knowing that the malpractice system is out there allows for a bit of a check, if you will, mm-hmm. to slow us down. Because I'm sure when you're seeing 60, 70, 80 patients a day and you feel this constant need, okay, next one, next one, next one, next one, I got to keep the rooms going. It's very easy to write brief notes, lack of notes. But I think knowing that there's always that risk, just like it did for me on the weekend, where it gave me a reason to pause just for a moment.
Right.
And say, you know what, you're tired. And that was the other thing. That day I'd been up since about 4 in the morning. That's why I wanted to go home. I was really tired.
Yeah.
But knowing that that possibility is there brought me back to the table.
Yeah.
And so I hate to say it's a fear-based motivation, but I do see it as, you know, a positive. And the other thing that I would, you know, simply point out, not simply, but it's the other side of it, which is the practitioners, the lawyers who are defending, or not defending, sorry, who are, you know, the plaintiff's lawyers.
Yes.
I understand what they're trying to do. They are trying to provide for their client. It's not just about, you know, giving them money to compensate them for the injury that has happened to their child. That's part of it, I think. But the greater part of it is these children require hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions over a lifetime of support, not all of which is going to be covered, you know, by the province's healthcare systems, especially if they want extra physio, extra OT, extra speech language, private psychologists. This has a dollar value attached to it. And then you add to that lost productivity for the child themselves and needing to be able to ensure that they will be able to be supported and have, once the parents are gone, you know, have some money that can support them. So I don't begrudge the system, I guess is what I would say. I think it's there to support.
Yeah. Well, that's a very compassionate view of it, I think. And just to, you know, I'm interested in your comment that you said the medical legal risk in your job are quite fear-based, but I can see that you have a very balanced view of it. You see it as a necessary part of the system, but fear-based. But I think you're not, I mean, I know you're not alone in that. I've almost never talked to a doctor or a nurse who hasn't had some level of fear around the medical legal system. But I found as an expert, it helped me to learn why medical malpractice exists, and it isn't there to get you and make your life difficult. it's really there to promote patient safety and protect the patient, and then take care of the patient if they're injured at the hands of the healthcare providers by no fault of their own. You know, that's the thing. So I think I just have one more question for you, and I'd like you to answer this from three perspectives, if you will. The podcast listeners that we have include lawyers, healthcare providers, and the general public. And I'd like you to answer this question for each one of those audiences. Mm-hmm. In your view, what is the most thing, let's start with lawyers, what is the most important thing that you'd like lawyers to know about neonatal lawsuits?
I think the most important thing, I think, is to recognize that, and we talked about a little bit about this in the webinar, the CPS statements and practice points are a consensus-based approach to care. We try to state now more and more in the statements what the level of the evidence is for something. And I think that, as I said at the outset of this podcast, we all are exposed to the same literature, yet sometimes we come up with different perspectives on it. Yeah. And so I think that it's not black and white. You know, so much of what we do is not black and white, and there will be variations in how people approach problems in their own center. Some of them may be, in my estimation, a little outlandish, but most of them are going to be pretty close to the mean. And the other thing that's interesting is just how opinions can differ between neonatologists. I had a very interesting experience of working on a case which is still active, so I won't go into too much detail, except to say, serendipitously, three neonatologists, including myself, discovered we'd all been asked for opinions on the same case. With permission from the lawyer who was involved and who had solicited all three of our opinions, we had a conversation together.
You all knew each other?
Yeah, we worked together. Yeah,
we worked together.
We'd all, at various points in my career, we had worked together.
Right.
But we didn't, none of us up till that point knew that we'd all been asked to give opinions on the case. Mm-hmm. And what was described by the senior person in the group was, he said to me, you know, I'm here, you're here, and the other neonatologist is here. Meaning, I think that in general, opinions are pretty consistent. I think that's one thing that I would say, is that I think opinions are pretty consistent. There is going to be fine points we may differ on, but I think that the gist of the opinion is going to be probably similar, just based on that one experience. That, and I would say I'd read in the same case, I'd read an opinion from a doctor who I know, who was shared with me. And I read the opinion after I had already formulated my own opinion. And we were, you know, very, very subtly different in our wording, but pretty close.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because sometimes those opinions are miles apart.
Yes, I've seen that. Yes. You know where I've seen that more so, though? I've noticed that on the obstetrical side. Mm. It seems to me, you know, the whole process of interpreting these, you know,
Tracings. Yeah.
You know, I'll see one obstetrician say, didn't think it was that bad, the variability seemed reasonable. Another one say, no variability or absent. Yeah. One's worried about variability cells. The other one thinks the tracing's not very reliable, you know. So I think you get a little bit more variability there.
Right.
But I think on the neonatal side, I've not seen, and radiology, I've also noticed, you sometimes see very different opinions about the same images. Depending on which part of the country you're asking.
Yes. Yes, that can be very true. All right. Well, that was a great answer for lawyers. So answer that same question for healthcare providers. And you can break this down separate for doctors and nurses if you choose. But what is the, in your view, what's the most important thing based on your experience as a clinician and now as someone who's provided expert opinion, most important thing that healthcare providers need to know about neonatal lawsuits?
I think the most important thing is do not take it as a personal attack. It's very easy to take it as a personal attack, but I remember being in court as an expert witness a case, the Crown versus Giesbrecht, which has been resolved here in Manitoba. And I remember being in there and being cross-examined as an expert witness, as a neonatologist. And there was a moment like that, because I could see I don't easily get riled up, but I could feel as I'm being cross-examined, it was about an hour and 45 on the stand. And by about the 1 hour 20 point of being going over the same thing over and over and over again and attacking different ways of looking at it, I was getting emotional.
Yeah.
And I was starting to, I noticed I gave one answer and not intentionally, but I sensed that it may have come across as showing I was getting a bit irritated.
Right.
And I took a moment, and this is the message I would give to all the healthcare providers. I took a moment and I said to myself, this is not about you. You know, this is about a lawyer doing his job and trying to give the best defense for his client.
Right.
He doesn't know you. He actually doesn't care about you, like as far as worrying about what you're having
as a person. Tonight.
You know, or whether you're going to have a nice evening after this. And that's not to say they're wishing ill of me, but this is all about trying to find some sort of weakness to exploit, to create doubt.
Sure.
And to be able to just simply say, well, there could be some doubt about how solid my answer is. And so once I said that to myself, I just came right down.
Good.
And I thought, just answer the questions.
Yeah.
It's not about you. Yeah. And that's the same thing I would say to the doctors and the nurses out there is, if this is, don't get me wrong, if I open a letter someday, as I told Joe before, I get a letter from any lawyer, any, as soon as I see law office and it's mailed to me, my blood pressure goes up and I think, is this the day, right?
Yeah. Thankfully, it's not your favorite day. No.
However, what I would say is to all of us out there, just remember, just like we have a job to provide care for the patients that we care for, lawyers have jobs to provide a defense or to prosecute for perceived wrongdoing.
Yeah.
And once you realize that this is a job no different than the job you're providing. They care about their clients. We care about our patients.
Yeah.
And this is a process. And ultimately, I would like to think that the law will do what's right. So the process will do what's right. So if you are named and there is no case, there will be no case.
Right.
But if there is something clearly that was some wrongdoing, then what I would say to them is accept it and use it. And, you know, write in your brain, if this ever happens again, I will not do this.
Right. Exactly.
I'll learn from it.
Well, that's really, really good advice. And I hope it's very calming to any doctor or nurse in the country who has been or currently being named in the lawsuit. But I hope it's also a really good lesson too for healthcare experts who do expert witness work, because certainly the cross-examination on the stand, we didn't get into that in any big at any great length today, but that single experience is what keeps doctors and nurses from doing expert witness work sometimes, because they're so frightened of that, what can be a very highly adversarial experience. So I think you just gave some good advice on many, many different levels there. So thank you. And another question along that same line, in your view, what is the most important thing that the general public, that the mothers and the fathers and the grandparents of the babies who are being born need to know about neonatal lawsuits?
I think what they need to know is that, well, a few things, really. I think, number one, I really do believe people go into healthcare because they want to help people. I don't believe, I mean, there's, you hear the occasional sensational story about somebody who is not mentally well, who is in healthcare and has been intentionally harming people. But, you know, that's the one in 10 million, right? The people who go into healthcare go in because they have a genuine desire to help. And so sometimes, despite everybody's best efforts, things can go wrong. And much like I had to sit in a witness stand and I had to come to the realization that this was not about me, this was not about somebody trying to hurt me, I think that it's okay to grieve, it's okay to be angry and go through all the stages of grief, you know, and getting over that. If you need to pursue a lawsuit, that's your prerogative. And sometimes, so I guess my message is sometimes despite all of our best intentions, things go wrong. And if they go wrong and you feel you need to pursue a lawsuit, then you do what you have to do. And in part, if there has been something missed, if there's been something, you know, that was not done properly, you know, much like when we say, why should parents go into consent for research in the NICU? I just told a family just yesterday, and my answer, I said, you know what, this research study may not help your baby at all. However, the findings of this research study may inform practice and be better for others. And so I liken that same approach to lawsuits. You know what? The lawsuit isn't going to do anything to fix what's wrong with your baby. The damage that happened is done. And we can't, as much as we'd like to go back and erase it, we can't. But aside from a monetary acknowledgement of the injury that's occurred, the lawsuit may help inform practice and prevent it from happening again elsewhere.
Yeah.
So I think that is what I always tell families. And, you know, that it's very difficult, as I said earlier, not to take it personally. But, yeah, you know, I'd like to think that if my time comes and I am named at some point, I hope I never am, but if I am, that I will have the courage to be able to say to myself, this isn't about you. Yeah. You know, this is, if an error happened, this is about process and this is about ensuring that it doesn't happen again. So
yeah. That was such a good answer. That was a really great answer. And just again, from multi different perspectives and with such compassion and understanding. And I feel quite confident that you will have the courage to do what you have to do if the day ever comes, but I'm just going to pray the day never comes for you. So let's just call that. Well, I think with that, we'll finish off this podcast. I just want to say thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today again. It really has been. It's very insightful. You're very well-spoken and compassionate, such a good teacher. If you haven't heard the shorter podcast titled About Dr. Michael Narvi, be sure to listen to it. He's going to share some more personal parts of himself, including I'm going to ask him what his superpower is, and I'm dying to hear what that lesson is. If you enjoyed this podcast, it would mean the world to us if you would subscribe wherever you listen. It helps us to gain popularity and ensures that you won't miss anything new as it's released. And if you've got ideas or topics that you'd like to hear about or have talked about or have me talk about, please feel free to get in touch through the website connectmlx.com. There's a really easy contact us button, which will find its way to me. So don't be shy if you have questions. I always look forward to hearing from the audience and appreciate your comments. So once again, thank you so much, Dr. Narvi.
Thank you. Real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And thanks to all of you who listened. Take good care and goodbye.